Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
European central bankers to the rescue. A new bond buying plan rallies world markets. We'll explain with bonbons. The art and business of speech making. And got milk? The latest numbers say no. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Podcast for Thursday, September 6th. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Ryssdal. Here's the scintillating headline from a press release we got from the European Central Bank this morning. Technical features of outright monetary transactions. Well, turns out that sleep-inducing headline is the big story today and helped inspire a big rally on Wall Street. The S&P 500 closed at its highest level in 4 years. So what happened? Well, the European Central Bank announced its so-called Big Bazooka, a new plan to save the euro and stem the debt crisis. The bank's going to buy the bonds of struggling eurozone governments that ask for help and, in return, more austerity. From the European desk in London, Stephen Beard reports.
If you've ever wondered what a big bazooka sounds like, here it is.
We will have a fully effective backstop to avoid destructive scenarios.
ECB chief Mario Draghi says he'll defend the euro. He'll buy up those eurozone government bonds that investors are dumping and so keep borrowing costs in check. We're talking really impressive weaponry here, says Pierre Briançon of Reuters Breaking Views.
It is definitely, from the European Central Bank's point of view, a big bazooka, because the key word here in their new policy of buying sovereign bonds is unlimited.
Who can match the ECB's firepower when it can print its own money? The plan did not disappoint. Stock markets on both sides of the pond jumped for joy, but not everyone was impressed. Is this the big bazooka?
In a nutshell, no.
Raoul Ruparel of the Open Europe think tank.
Ultimately, it tackles a symptom of the crisis, but not the underlying causes of the crisis.
He says Draghi's new weapon won't zap the euro's fundamental problem, the big divergence between the strong and weak economies that use the same currency. He thinks the market enthusiasm will fizzle, and within a month, Mario's bazooka may look more like a BB gun. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Okay, bazookas, BB guns, do you get it yet? Well, here to simplify this European bond-buying spree for us is Marketplace's own Patty Hirsch, who says it helps to think about something sweet.
To understand this bond-buying spree that the European Central Bank is about to embark on, I find it helps to think about candy. Let's imagine each country in Europe is a candy shop. So you have this string of candy shops around Europe. Each sells different kinds of candy, rock candy, peanut brittle, Skittles. But all of them sell their own variety of what we'll call sovereign bonbons. Now, in some stores, these sovereign bonbons aren't selling too well. So the candy store owners have asked a big investor to help. The investor thinks this has a simple solution: supply and demand. If he buys up a bunch of the bonbons in, say, Greece, Spain and Italy, people will see how popular those candies are, and demand for them will go up. And that will allow the store owners to charge more. In return for this favour, the candy store owners have agreed to clean up their shops, not spend too much on things like candy display cases or fancy bonuses for their workers. In other words, tighten up their budgets. Store employees might even be paid less, although they'll probably still get the same vacation. And the investor? Well, he can sell those bonbons if he wants, or he might hold on to them until they mature. So to break down the analogy here, the candy stores are European countries. The investor is the ECB. The sovereign bonbons are bonds. And when demand for bonds goes up, interest rates go down, which is what the ECB and the Eurozone nations all want. But, I hear you ask, what happens when those bonds mature? Well, if those nations are solvent, the ECB will get paid. Sweet! If they're not, well, it'll leave a bad taste in everyone's mouth.
Patty Hirsch is Marketplace's senior producer of personal finance. President Obama tonight gives one of the most important speeches of his life at the Democratic Convention. Both he and former President Clinton, who spoke last night, seem pretty at ease in front of a big crowd. Clinton spoke for more than 45 minutes, some of it ad-libbed. And it made us wonder, what about the rest of us? How would we do in front of a crowd that size? Well, today there's a big business behind public speaking. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Friends, listeners, countrymen, lend me your ears. If you want to become a better public speaker, well, that'll cost you.
Well, the kind of training I offer is expensive, and there's no doubt about that.
Eileen Pincus is a speech trainer. She works mostly with high-level executives, and her rates range from $100 to $500 an hour. For that, you get one-on-one coaching, objective feedback, and tips. One tip Pincus has is not to focus all your attention on your delivery. And she says everyone she coaches gets nervous. You might worry the audience is judging you.
You know what? They are. And that's the power in this, is that you're going to let them judge you. You're going to let them see your great ideas and communicate them.
These days, communicating great ideas is important. Brian Callahan is a public speaking consultant based in Washington, and he says the price of what he offers is worth it.
It's the good presenters, it's the good public speakers, it's the confident communicators who are rising up the business ladder.
Another consultant, Stephanie Silverman, says business is up since the economic downturn. She says effective public speaking skills are a way to get a leg up on your competition.
I think that what was once considered a throwaway soft skill has been growing in importance as people begin to realize that knowing your business is not enough.
Silverman says it takes practice and work to communicate comfortably. And I should know, it's not easy to butcher one of Shakespeare's most famous lines on a national radio show. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Wall Street celebrated Europe's big bazooka. Details when we do the numbers. President Reagan famously asked the question in 1980, and the Republicans are asking it this campaign season. Are you better off than you were 4 years ago? So, what does America really think?
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said!
Joining us to talk about the are you better off question is Frank Newport. He's the editor-in-chief at Gallup, and he's here for our regular attitude check. Frank, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
So here we have this seemingly simple question, right? Are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Your organization has asked people that question. What did you find?
We simply said, are you better off than you were 4 years ago or not? For registered voters across the country, a majority, 55%, said they were not better off than they were 4 years ago.
Now, other pollsters, unnamed pollsters out there, Frank, have asked that question and gotten different responses. Why is that?
You mean those nefarious other pollsters out there, not Gallup? Well, it's not unusual in polling to ask questions in different ways. And the big distinction is that some other polling organizations, well-meaning polling organizations, have given Americans a middle alternative, which is that they're the same as they were 4 years ago. And when pollsters do that, at least the polls that I've seen, you still find that the plurality of Americans who make a choice say they are worse off rather than better off. But you have a bigger percent, or at least a sizable percent, who will say, oh, yeah, I'm about the same as I was 4 years ago. And of course, that leads to some matters of interpretation. But the tilt is always towards worse off rather than better off.
Do you think they're just thinking about their pocketbooks, the bottom line? Or do you think they may be thinking about other things in their lives? What do you assume, Frank, as a pollster, that they are basing their answer on?
We do know one thing. We do track Americans' perceptions of their personal life and their well-being and a lot of other things along those lines, and those don't change nearly as much as their perception of what's going on out there in the large world around them. So I don't think that when Americans say they are not better off than they were 4 years ago, they're necessarily thinking about things in their personal life, because those generally are on a pretty steady keel. Most likely it has to do with these broader things going on in the economic environment, in the political environment, the social environment, the kind of things we've been talking about.
So, Frank, let me be the pollster for a minute and put you on the spot. Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?
absolutely the same as I was 4 years ago, because we are now in the middle of a political campaign, which is pollster heaven. You know, we love it when there's all this conflict going on that we can measure public opinion about. And back four years ago, we were in the middle of a campaign election, presidential election at that point. So I'm perfectly happy then, and I'm perfectly happy now. How's that for an answer?
Very good answer, Frank. Frank Newport is editor-in-chief at Gallup. Frank, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
And we did our own little poll here asking that same question, whether you're better off now than you were 4 years ago. And here's what you told us.
I'm better off now, primarily because my wife's employer is doing better, so she has larger bonuses. That means more discretionary income for us.
I wish I could say I was, but because we haven't had raises in 3 years, the answer is no. The few extra dollars in our pay, thanks to the tax breaks, doesn't offset the increase in gas, electric, home heating oil, propane, and groceries alone have risen for us $25 to $35 per week in the last 3 years.
I am not. 4 years ago, I had a good job doing engineering and design work for a local GM automotive supply plant. The plant closed in 2009, and I lost my job. In my current job, I do similar work, but for less pay with longer hours. But I'm thankful that I'm employed.
This question is so selfish. What happened to ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country?
Just a few of our listeners, Andrew Joubert, Jason Worley, Faith Abbott-Bowden, and John Eisenberg, who all wrote on our Facebook page, voiced by some of our Marketplace crew. Tell us what you think about whether you're better off now than you were 4 years ago, and why. Just go to our Facebook page. Well, Kansas City may consider itself better off than the rest of the country, at least when it comes to high-speed internet. It recently beat out more than 1,000 other cities to be the first in the U.S. to get something called Google Fiber. That's a super-fast internet service, 100 times faster than current speeds. Google's also offering its own cable TV service. But the competition in Kansas City isn't over. Now, the city's neighborhoods are duking it out to see who will get the service and who gets it first. From KCUR, Maria Carter has the story.
Yvette Roberts is one of about a dozen people stopping at a Google Fiber registration event in the basement of St. James Church. She says she didn't know what Google Fiber was when she saw it in the church newsletter. She puts her most pressing question to Google's Luke Carlson.
The major thing that I need to know is that, do you guys have the NFL package?
We have the NFL Network and the NFL Red Zone as of right now.
She'd be less excited to find out Google hasn't signed on some other big channels like ESPN to their lineup. They say they're working on it. Google's doing things differently than most cable and internet companies. Google's Kevin Lowe says they're having people in Kansas City do the market research for them.
Rather than us decide where and when we should build, we decided, hey, let's ask Kansas Cityans and ask them to let us know their interest by literally going to a website and pre-registering.
Google will only bring its fiber service to neighborhoods where enough people pay the $10 registration fee. They're relying on excited customers like Roberts, who plans to get in touch with her neighbors.
Oh, most definitely. I will be sending text messages to make sure that they get down to the location where the sign-up is for our neighborhood.
If Roberts can't get enough of her neighbors to sign up, then Google won't bring the fiber optic cable to her neighborhood. Google's calling this approach a rally, and it looks like a grassroots political campaign, complete with yard signs, flyers, and enthusiastic supporters. Heck, they even have a pair of ice cream trucks rolling around town to drum up support.
We're on the ice cream sandwich.
Thank you.
At a sign-up event outside a local community center, Tanya Sippel grabs a plate of barbecue. She volunteers for the city parks department, but faced a problem when she tried to sign up.
I brought cash, and they said they need debit, and we don't have a debit card at this time.
Workers tell her she can get a Visa gift card at the Walgreens across the street and use it to register. This is just one of the challenges Google faces in trying to cross the so-called digital divide. Google's research shows about a quarter of all Kansas Cityans don't have broadband at home, and that skews by race, education, and income. Google's Kevin Lowe says it comes down to two basic factors, relevance and affordability.
It's certainly not Google's role to solve the entire problem, but we really wanted to take advantage of this opportunity to do what we can.
And what they're doing is offering something they call free internet. It's not super fast, and it's not exactly free. Customers are expected to pay the $300 installation fee, then they get normal broadband speeds for 7 years. Christopher Barnacle is the assistant director at the Kansas City, Kansas Public Library, where many people now come to use the internet. He says affordability is only part of the problem.
And then there's just the fact of the matter that certain people don't have computers in the homes. And if you don't have computers, what good does the internet?
Whether enough people in all neighborhoods will sign on is still being decided. Google recently made it easier for some places, lowering the number of signups needed to get service. After complaints, some homes were empty. The final registration push ends Sunday. In Kansas City, I'm Maria Carter for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Government is in all of our lives. You know, it's not like this is a maker and taker world. We're all makers and we're all takers.
As the political debate swirls, a reporter's quest to find out exactly how much of our lives is subsidized. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street soared to pre-recession levels on positive economic news at home and an aggressive central bank move in Europe. The S&P 500 climbed 28 points, or 2%, to close at 1432, its highest level since January of 2008. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 244 points, or 1.9%, to close at 13,292. The Nasdaq hit a 12-year high. It leapt 66 points, 2.2%, to finish at 3135. The ECB debt move we told you about boosted American financial stocks. Bank of America deposited 5%. Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase gained more than 4% each. European markets surged on the ECB move. London's FTSE rose 2.1%. France's CAC 40 picked up 3%, and the German DAX gained nearly 3%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.68%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports unemployment figures for August. The Association of Food Journalists concludes its annual conference in the nation's capital. And the sports channel ESPN launched on September 7th, 1979. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdal. This summer's extreme heat and drought will be with us for a while, and you don't have to look further than the dairy section of your grocery store. Analysts expect milk prices to rise sharply over the next few months thanks to higher feed costs and lower production. But dairy farmers may have a bigger worry. Americans have been turning up their noses at milk for other reasons. Marketplace's Amy Scott found out why.
We've been drinking less and less milk per person for decades, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Milk producers blame competition from newfangled products like coconut water and sports drinks.
People are drinking these new and interesting beverages at the expense of milk.
Vivian Godfrey is CEO of the trade group behind the Got Milk ad campaign. She says the biggest threat isn't all that new, aside from the container.
The single beverage, though, that has really taken share away from milk over the past decade is bottled water.
Why water? Jerry Dreyer is an analyst and consultant to dairy processors. He says it may be the shelf life.
You can have a bottle of water sitting around for 6 months and finally chill it and drink it. That doesn't work with a glass of milk.
There is such a thing as shelf-stable milk, no fridge required. But Dreyer says the industry hasn't done a good job of selling it in the U.S. Some milk sales have shifted to other forms of dairy, like yogurt. Then there are all those milk alternatives.
Okay, here I am at the dairy case. Got soy milk, vanilla, plain. We've got almond milk, unsweetened, sweetened, vanilla.
Research firm Mintel says health concerns and lactose intolerance are driving more people to seek substitutes. Cow's milk producers are fighting back. The Got Milk folks have some new campaigns pushing breakfast at home. Turns out cereal sales are down too. And promoting, of all things, chocolate milk as a post-workout drink. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Chances are you have a waterproof raincoat, right? Or stain-resistant khakis. There are all kinds of high-tech fabrics that promise to keep us drier and cleaner. But retail giant H&M says it's going to stop using some of them. Because all that high performance, well, it comes from chemicals, the kind that don't go away. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
No one shopping at H&M is looking for long-lasting clothes, says Morningstar analyst Jamie Katz.
It's fast fashion. You can buy something that's trendy. It's fairly priced.
And you'll probably toss it after a few seasons. You can't really call disposable fashion green. But H&M has made a PR push on environmental issues, says Katz.
Taking the initiative to do things kind of in a better way for everybody.
H&M's partnered with sportswear giants like Nike, Adidas, and Puma to root out one type of chemical in particular, PFCs, or perfluorinated chemicals. They're the secret ingredient for clothes that repel water or resist stains, says Sonia Lunder at the Environmental Working Group, like Gore-Tex. And it's a bit ironic that the people most likely to wear these clothes spend lots of time in nature, because the reason PFCs work so well is they pretty much never decompose.
These chemicals really came onto our radar screen because they were being detected in environmental samples and also in people. They're found in everybody's blood and everybody's body.
Now, you don't get PFCs in your body by wearing a Gore-Tex jacket. They get into the water and the food chain from factory runoff. Outdoor companies like Patagonia have worked on alternatives to PFCs for years, says Lunder. H&M doesn't use nearly as much of the chemicals, but its size makes this a big deal.
It's one thing to be able to buy a $400 raincoat that doesn't use toxic chemicals, but it's even better when that option is available to more people.
H&M will stop ordering fabrics with PFCs in January. With the quick turnaround of the fast fashion world, its clothes will be free of the chemicals by February. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
One of the biggest issues that seems to divide Republicans and Democrats is government. How big should it be, what its purpose is, and just how much we should rely on it for our well-being. Well, Michael Grunwald has just written a very thought-provoking story for Time magazine that digs into all the many ways in which government subsidizes our lives, both Democrats and Republicans, and a lot of them go unnoticed. Michael, thanks for joining us as you take a break from the Democratic convention.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Michael, what are you doing at the convention?
You know, I'm covering it just like the other 15,000 reporters here.
You decided to tackle this story partly by looking at all the things that are subsidized in your own life. You made it rather personal. So paint a picture for us.
Well, you know, I had just written a book about the stimulus and had been sort of stunned by the way it seemed perfectly logical to people that $800 billion would be completely wasted on people that had nothing to do with them. And I did realize that, hey, you know, government is in all of our lives. You know, it's not like this is a maker and taker world. We're all makers and we're all takers. That, you know, my housing is subsidized because I have a mortgage interest deduction. That my savings are subsidized because a 401k has a tax exemption. You know, that just about every part of our lives is subsidized in some way.
So in your reporting, was there any subsidy that actually really struck you as outrageous or really shocked you?
Well, I've banged my spoon on my high chair about farm subsidies for years. I think there are about $700 billion in spending that we do that's actually environmentally destructive. That's pretty crazy. And the mortgage deduction in particular, which, again, it benefits homeowners over renters. It benefits wealthy homeowners over less wealthy homeowners. That's another one where it just it may have run its course.
So, Michael, in the end, what do you want both Republicans and Democrats to take away from your reporting?
You know, it's interesting. I think that there are some critiques from the left and the right that are pretty powerful and true. I think, you know, the right has made this case for years that government does way more than it needs to. And I think that's really true. You know, I live in Miami Beach. Does government really need to be dumping sand in South Beach for, you know, so that tourists and my family can enjoy it more? You know, I'm not sure about that. You know, certainly does it need to be subsidizing farmers? Maybe not. At the same time, liberals have made the case that, hey, you know, we rely on government a lot more than we think. And I think that's true, too, that government really does support us in many ways, not just outrageous ways, but ways that are part of our everyday lives. And so I think, you know, if both sides could maybe recognize a little bit more that, you know, in fact, we are makers and we are takers, that the government does support us, and maybe it does support us more than we need.
Michael Grunwald is the Time Magazine senior national correspondent and the author of The New New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And finally, ever wonder what the smartest folks in the room are paying on their mortgages? Well, thanks to financial disclosure rules, we found out what Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke's paying. He's the guy who helped set interest rates, of course. Bernanke refinanced his 30-year mortgage last year at a rate of 4.25%. Not bad, Mr. Chairman, but this summer the average rate for a 30-year fixed fell to about 3.49%. Maybe time for another refi. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 244 points, 1.9% to end the day at 13,292. The Nasdaq leapt 66 points, 2.2% to finish at 3135. And the S&P 500 climbed 28 points, or 2% to close at 1432. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Sarah Gardner. Hope you could join us tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.